Hello, my name is Craig, and here with me today is Nicole and Kristen. Can you guys say hi?
Good morning.
Hello, everybody.
So this is the first time that we've actually had Kristen on air with us, so thank you for joining us here.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
All right. So you guys are tuning into another episode of Mental Health Insights, and today, as promised, or at least I promised next time that I have Nicole on, we're going to talk about ways to reduce your stress response, or at least kind of get you back into that parasympathetic functioning faster. So if you have not listened to the other episode on the stress response, I would recommend that you listen to that first. However, that is not going to be, it's not necessary, because most of us, we know what it feels like to have stress and anxiety. So being able to do different things to calm us down, I feel like that's a pretty normal conversation for most of us to have. So one of the things that I kind of want to just ask you ladies first is, I think that we were talking a little bit off air, and I think this is just normal for therapists in general. I think all of us are kind of anxious bodies. So I know that all of us have our own little methods or own little ways that we use to try to calm ourselves down, whether or not that's before session, during session, or just in everyday life. So can you guys tell me, like, what are your personal go-to things that you guys do? And either one of you guys can go first.
I like to say I try everything that I tell my clients to do, and one of my favorite practices is what I call the five senses exercise, where I'm paying attention to my immediate surroundings. What do I see, hear, smell, taste, and feel? And I repeat that over and over and over again until I notice myself coming back into my body and into the here and now, which is really relaxing. And all of my clients come back to me and say they really love that. It's very effective to reduce the stress response and also to reduce those circular thoughts that they can have.
Now, do you pick a new thing each time that you're cycling through those five, or?
You know, it depends what kind of mood I'm in. Sometimes no, sometimes yes. If you're ever at Creve Coeur Lake and you hear somebody yelling out leaves and water and trees and blue sky, that's me doing that exercise. So I find fun ways to incorporate it into my life. But I just like things that work, and that seems to do the trick.
Yeah, I think the thing with that, because I've done that one before, and I don't know if you've done that before. I always have such trouble with taste. Because I'm like, oh, like, how does my mouth taste right
Pop
now?
Pop some gum.
Yeah, and I
don't. Or mint or something.
I don't
something.
Think, like, oh, I should, like, go and, like, try, like, especially that qualm smelling thing. All right, I know how it smells. Like, how does that fragrance actually taste when it's going through my mouth or anything like that? So that's just a weird thing. I am a big gum person, though, admittedly. I don't know how that helps me at all, but
it's very like grounding. At my most anxious moments, I will go buy a pack of gum just because it's like the sensory experience that brings me back. And it also lets me get some of that energy out if I can't go exercise or something.
Yeah. How about you, Nicole?
I think that's really good. And I keep little candies in my desk drawer. And I know when I worked, in grief work, sometimes having peppermint when people are feeling grief or that vagus nerve is kind of triggered, peppermint or mint is really a nice thing to kind of calm that epinephrine down. And it just brings you in the here and now. You can feel the cool. And I'll notice and think of, like, colors or blue or something like that to kind of bring it down when you think about it.
Yeah. So you go from, like, how can my biochemistry be soothed right now?
That's all I think about.
She's
Craig.
A scientist.
So I think of that. But, the brain doesn't know what's real and what's not. And so I think that's really important when we're thinking of anxiety. If you work on your mind and visualizations and being able to pendulate from this body state of being anxious and feeling that panic in your chest, so just noticing and even having gratitude towards it can brain shift too, just to say, oh, here it is, here's the epinephrine, let me notice that, what is that trying to do for me, or how is that helpful in the situation, and kind of shifting from there and then going into the grounding technique.
I think that the way that I reduce my anxiety is so very different than what you two do. You guys do more like
do tell.
So you guys do what's more research based, I would say, right? So especially like the different present moment processes or anything like that, which sounds much more like what you guys are doing. But from a very young age, actually maybe it wasn't even a young age. Maybe it's probably around like 8 to 12 or something like that, I started coming up with this mantra as a very anxious child, which I think that you guys said that you guys both were too. So I'm sure that you guys have had to plug a lot of different strategies. So my strategy was, if whatever I was doing was not likely to result in me dying, then I shouldn't be afraid of it. So that's something that I ask myself all the time. Like, even as, you know, every time that I'm on air or I'm doing an interview or anything like that, or even doing this podcast, you know, you get like those little bit of the jitters or anything like that. That's kind of like the thing that's in the back of my mind is, okay, like, if this podcast really messes up, like, am I actually in any danger or anything like that? So I actually do a little bit of reality testing, which is kind of funny because research actually says that that's probably the worst thing to do. All right. So, I actually want to talk a little bit about that. So whenever we have a newer wave of research, and what you guys just kind of talked about demonstrates this really well, whereas whenever you do things that are in the present moment, and whenever you're doing things that are taking your attention off the different anxieties that you have on a very physical basis, it is actually shown to help reduce your anxiety more. Whereas if you're thinking about it, right, you're actually like trying to combat the anxiety by overthinking it or trying to counter the thoughts or anything like that, it actually becomes really difficult. So I'm sitting here thinking, listening to you guys, and I'm like, man, I really take the hard route with this.
I love that you said that, Craig, because what I teach my clients is this bottom-up processing. Mm-hmm. So the techniques that Kristen and I are using are really calming that limbic system down, that amygdala, that vagus nerve, and it's allowing us to be in a present state where we're kind of gear shifting. We talked about in the last podcast, like first to second gear in the old manual cars is kind of shifting from that physical sensation of the epinephrine. Mm-hmm. By the time we're in fourth, it's a little smoother. In fifth, then you're able to be in your cognition and kind of do some of that reframing, or I'm doing okay where I'm at, I'm doing the best I can, or some of those positive mm-hmm. mantras by that state. But if I'm lower than that, I'm not able to shift that quickly.
Well, I kind of wonder, I know that we talked about this a little bit last episode. Can you remind me the difference between like bottom up and top
down? I love that. Yeah, so bottom up would just really be that downstairs brain that Dan Siegel talks about. So that would be an emotional state. It's our subconscious. It's our previous memories. The amygdala is taking in intention with those five senses. Mm-hmm. So what Kristen's doing is tapping right into that amygdala, and it's calming the vagus nerve that's that choked up in our throat, down to our chest, into that mm-hmm. pit in your stomach. It actually physically starts shifting that. And so the higher up it gets, the better. So when I have clients that have a lot of, you know, pressure or pain in the stomach, it's pretty deep. It's pretty old pain or anxiety. It's been used a lot. Mm-hmm. As it gets higher up into the throat and into the head, that's processing upward. Upward would be more of that prefrontal cortex and that parasympathetic, where now we're cognitive.
Mm-hmm. As you're talking about this, like, I can feel all of those sensations because I'm an anxiety person and my brain just goes right to it. Mm-hmm. I have been, I think I shared with you, I've been married now to my husband for 4 years. We just celebrated our fourth anniversary, and he is not a therapist, but he is the most amazing source of information as far as like how to cope with stress. He has like this whole plan in his mind and like an approach. And so what he does is he gives himself something to look forward to every week. And typically that is a date night for us away from the kids, which is really important. But he also skateboards. And so he skateboarded since he was a child. He actually was pro for a while, which I think is a fun fact. But we're talking about coping skills in a very clinical way and scientific way, but for layman people, I think it comes down to have fun, like tap into that child part of yourself that was carefree. What does that for you? And the five senses exercise, you know, is a little more scientific, but if it's skateboarding, going for a walk, going mm-hmm. for a run, anything active that gets you in touch back into your body, I think is really effective, and it doesn't have to be more complicated than that. You don't have to know all the science to make it happen.
Well, I think that's one of the important things too. Like a lot of times people be like, hey, if you're really stressed out, what do you need to do in order to calm down? It's like, hey, exercise is a really great thing.
Yeah.
And I know for me, whenever I'm exercising, I can't really think about a lot of other things except exercising, which is really strange because, like, even if you're running or something like that, you feel like, oh, like, I know how to put one foot in front of the other, and I can just keep doing it. Like, I should be able to think about whatever I want. But strangely enough, it kind of keeps you in the present moment. Mm-hmm. And
well, it's bilateral stimulation when you're running.
Oh,
if
yeah.
you know anything about EMDR and bilateral stem, it makes sense.
I think we talked a little bit about that before, but just kind of like the reminder, that's whenever you get the two hemispheres of the brain that are really lighting up, which actually really helps promote information sharing between the two lobes or two halves of the brain. And I think that any type, so I think the exercise is the easy plug for anxiety a lot of times, because then you can kind of get your body into a state where as your body gets stimulated from the anxiety, it is more used to, rather than having your blood vessels constrict for your blood pressure to go up, the more and more exercise that you do, the easier and easier it is for your muscle, or not your muscles, your blood vessels to actually stay relaxed, which is one of the really beneficial perks that we can get. I think we maybe talked a little bit about this last time.
The endorphins too,
but I don't actually think that we got here. So like the best safe zone is whenever you get just a little bit of that edge of that anxiety, but it actually does not inhibit your mental functioning. So your body can be stimulated and your brain can be stimulated a little bit, but it's not actually shutting off functioning to the prefrontal cortex. I think the best way to describe this is that's kind of what it feels like whenever you're kind of like really on your game, right?
Yeah.
Everything's just kind of firing on
that's
all fronts
exactly
and everything.
How that feels.
Or I think some people call it flow. Whenever you get that little bit of excitement and your body's starting to get amped up into that stress response, but you're actually not going all the way. And exercise really helps get us there. But I think for the average person where exercise can be really hard, right, we have to find other strategies.
Or they don't like it.
Yeah.
A lot of my clients were like, well, Kristen, I don't like exercise. Well, I guess we have to come up with some other options.
Oh, yeah. So
one of the things I started doing this past year, because I had surgery and I wasn't able to do a lot of that, was Tai Chi. I never thought I'd want to do it. Mm-hmm. And Tai Chi is wonderful because you're focusing on breath and you're able to move in rhythmic motions of the body and you really kind of become more attuned to the body. And that's integrating as well as far as that brain and anxiety and kind of feeling better about, oh, I can do this. Mm-hmm. Even in a wheelchair, I have clients that have disabilities. You know, Tai Chi or yoga or Nidra yoga, those would be three very simple things you can do with breath and just body movement, just to be present in your body and relieve some of that. It can be very soothing.
I think it's impressive how big a jump that yoga has come in popularity, and I think with good reason, because, and like, I'm not really a big yoga person, but like, I've tried it before and you're like, oh wow, I don't know if there's anything that really quite gets you into your bodily experience more than yoga.
It's amazing.
Oh, yeah.
I have to be able to sit still long enough to do it, though, because I'm a busybody.
Yeah. I can relate to that, Kristen.
Oh, yeah. That's whenever you get into the situation where you're like, okay, I'll do a class with other people, because then you get the social pressure to conform to everybody.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
I kind of want to talk about, while I use that part to, all right, is this going to hurt me or is this dangerous or anything, to kind of calm myself down? So like a lot of times, especially as I've gotten older, that doesn't work because like we talked about before, that's a top down approach. And really that's not a great strategy for anxiety. So for me, one of the things that I've learned when I was learning about the stress response, I had an instructor tell me before, be like, hey, try to pick up what it is that you notice first whenever you're in your stress response. And it sounds kind of obvious, but it's actually, it's different for different people. So some people will notice that their heart's beating faster or muscles are tense, which I think we talked about last time. It's really hard to notice that because a lot of it's happening unconsciously. Or we'll start to notice our breathing go up. I think a lot of my clients, they'll notice their body temperature go up, or like they feel like their face is reddening or anything. So I actually notice my shoulders tense. That's the first thing that I notice whenever I am getting stressed, is for whatever reason my shoulders will tense. It does 100% of the time. So whenever I notice that, I know that I got to consciously relax my body.
Not everybody is as aware of their body as us therapists. I think it takes practice. I think many people spend a lot of time outside of paying attention to their body. And I notice that in session with clients when I ask them how their body is feeling. They're like, what? What do you mean? Like, mm-hmm. let's just sit with it. Scan from your head to your toes. What do you notice? So there's a lot of intentionality and practice that goes behind being in touch with your body enough to notice what's going on with it while you're stressed.
Oh, yeah. I love what you said, that scanning your body or, yep. like, body scan. When, like, even right now while I'm sitting here, like, I still notice I got a little bit of the excitement in my belly and everything, but mm-hmm. I can feel that. All right, my shoulders aren't tense like they normally are. I feel like, all right, my chest isn't normally tense. Like, body temperature is going up. Like, all right, I'm in a pretty good place right now, but I can still feel a little bit of the jolt from the butterflies in my stomach yeah. just from talking, right? And talking about something that I really enjoy talking about, but the same nervousness because I'm talking with two professionals. I don't want to say something wrong or anything like that. So I think that that body scan, I think you're right, it is easy for us to do it because we know this. But for anyone that's listening to this, like what we're talking about with the body scan is that's just literally just paying attention to your body, trying to take notice of things that are happening. Just like I explained to you right there, like where I kind of notice like the butterflies in my stomach or anything like that. There's a certain comfort that comes with being aware of those things.
You pulled it right out of my yeah. head. I was thinking that all of this awareness that you learn how to develop either in therapy or on your own gives you a sense of control. And anxiety is traditionally sort of like an enigma, like where is it coming from? So it demystifies your anxiety a bit.
I like the way that you explain that, actually.
Thank you.
Demystifies it. I never really thought of it in that context. And I think that the more and more we can kind of wrap our heads around that, okay, this is something that's happening in the body and in the brain. I may not be able to control the thoughts that are going on, but I have more control over my body, or at least I can mm-hmm. practice control over my body right. in a lot easier way. Right. My muscles are tense. I can learn to relax them. That's a lot easier for me to do that than to try to counter all the thoughts that my brain is coming up with, you know, 100 thoughts a second about how things can go wrong. And being able to do that body scan more and more often, I think it just becomes background, just like anything else. Like whenever you ride a bike and you have to learn how to do it.
Yeah.
Then after you ride a bike 100 times, you don't have to think about the speed at which the pedals go, or you don't have to mm-hmm. think about like, oh, I got to make sure I'm balancing this. It just happens automatically. Like I think that even while we've been talking about this, and you guys may have even done this too, like I've done a body scan several times and it just happens naturally. Mm-hmm. And that's the coolest thing about a lot of this present process stuff. Is it becomes so habitual, it becomes easy to do all the time to create that lasting change.
It is very easy to do to create lasting change. Exactly. It's just so simple.
Yeah.
And if we could just go back briefly, I love that you said it's kind of like what I call autopilot. So a lot of my clients will come in and say, well, this is just what happens to me, or this is just how my mind works. This is how it is for me. So think of like Highway 70 for us here in St. Louis. It's kind of in a roundabout circle. It's doing it without permission, and that's kind of that habitual piece. Mm-hmm. So by taking control, which is usually a huge piece in anxiety, taking control of the body of awareness, using observer part of your mind really shifts that gear as well as getting off the rumination train or off that highway, and it helps you hop on like page extension or like Highway 40. And I like to use those kind of analogies so people can kind of understand firing and wiring different neural networks for what their habits will be going forward.
Well, I think that like even you just said right there, like anxiety can become a habit.
Oh, it totally is. You're the neuroscience lady. What do you say? You cement those neural pathways, and right. your brain just goes to it.
It's like a feedback loop from the body to the thought. So whether you have a bad body sensation, then you start thinking, and it goes together. Or you start with a bad thought, and then the body says, oh, I remember that. That's what happens when we do this. So it's really important to kind of, you know, challenge some of those things in a relaxed state. It starts to, you know, develop those new networks, and it solidifies those kind of right
it's
on a
fun.
Pathway.
It's really fun to challenge yourself and your own thoughts and then see the change. Seeing the change is fun, not the challenging, because that you know is hard at first. Mm-hmm. But when you were talking about the highway, it was making me think of another coping skill or regulation skill, which is noticing your thoughts, which is the awareness, and then kind of putting them on a little train and moving them across your mind and just watching them go by rather than letting them sit and fester. Mm-hmm. And so just noticing and let them float away. Notice, let it float away.
Love it.
It's so helpful.
It really is. I use a cloud for that very same thing. I think that's
you can use
our trauma work, right?
Yeah.
It's very
yes.
similar. We have to do that a lot with trauma clients so they can even be present to be able to discuss or move or process through that trauma because their body is living in that past. It's still mm-hmm. there in the past. Mm-hmm. And so I love the train that they're moving forward, and that gives them a sense of control and empowers them to really feel like they're having mm-hmm. a difference in their work and their mm-hmm. therapy.
See, I like to be more playful with my thoughts. I don't like to absorb them. So, all right, I'm going to share this with you guys.
I'm excited.
I haven't ever shared this with anyone because it sounds really kiddy. Right. So, as we talked about last time, when we had anxiety, right, there are tons of thoughts that go into. So what I do is whenever these thoughts come up and they're really bothering me, I'll put them into a little ball, right? It's like a ball pit. And I'll throw them all into a container and I will jump, like mentally, I'll jump into that ball pit and just like thrash around, hit those things around anywhere. And like for me in those moments that like thrashing around, that like frustration of like all these thoughts being around, is kind of like me showing that like I can bat these around, I can throw them out of the pit if I want to, I have more control and authority over them, even if there is a ton of them. Because as you know, like even a little kid in a ball pit, like they can move and groove around in
yeah.
there. Like the balls are just slowing them down for a little bit. And I really like I got a big imagination, right? So I like doing different things, like imagining like a thought is like a block and like breaking it up or something mm-hmm. like that, especially different thoughts that I really don't care for or anything like that.
That's awesome. That's a great visual.
Yeah, I'm not good with I'm not good at just sitting there and kind of like just watching them go by, especially
right.
if it's a thought I don't like. I'm like, no, I want to do something to
this. I think I like yours better. That's way yeah. more fun. I love ball pits. Like yeah. every time I go to a ball pit now, I'm going to imagine that.
See, like, well, I didn't feel as bad about it whenever I would actually do this because I'd work with so many adolescents so that it was okay. It's uh-huh. like, oh, now I'm talking to adults. And now it's a little more embarrassing.
I think it's great. I think it's important to bring adults back to their like childhood consciousness. Mm-hmm. Play is very important even in adulthood. Because we're so serious all the time.
Yeah.
I love it. I play Don't Break the Ice with the babies, and I absolutely love it. It's like, I didn't realize I was so frustrated today as I'm nailing this mm-hmm. one ice cube through the, I don't know if you guys know the game, so it's a square, and these little ice cubes are put together, and you have one little mallet, and you just hit it very lightly, so you
oh, yeah.
knock everything around it. So you really have to get focused on hitting that one. So that's kind of funny you said that. I think there's a child in all of us, whether we're playing in a playground.
Oh, 100%. There's a
yeah.
child in you, and there may
yeah.
be several at
yeah.
different ages.
That's right, especially with anxiety and trauma.
Well,
it's
and
really important.
I think the beautiful thing about this is even what we're talking about is that your anxiety is going to be different than other people's, right? There's some similarities, of course. But what that means is like the thing that you find that helps you with your anxiety is also going to be completely yours, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there has to be a little yeah. bit of there has to be a little adventure in finding out what works for you, right? I mean, I think most of us, like whenever we first start with anxiety work with someone, we're like, oh, like, have you tried breathing exercises? And people hate breathing exercises, right? Because I think that's kind of what we're always taught. And they're like, oh, like breathing exercises don't work. I want to let you guys know that they do work. You're just not doing them long enough. But anyway, and that's kind of always the thing that I had to fall back on if nothing else is working is do breathing exercises. I have my little Fitbit here that has my heart rate monitor on. I like playing a game, seeing how low I can get my heart rate.
That sounds fun.
Oh, yeah. So I think that being able to find, like, the kid games or the fun in everything that you do really helps make it easier mm-hmm. to help you reduce this anxiety. We think of this anxiety a lot of times as this like overbearing force when it's really just a force of our body.
Yeah.
All right. And we can mess around with our body. I can move my arm, right? For those of you that you guys can't see, I'm moving my arm right here in this chair. I get the opportunity to move it and I can control my body. There are lots of other things of our body that we can control too, thus giving us some control over our anxiety.
Some control, right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Just one other thing I wanted to add about, you know, the curiosity. I think that's such an important part when we have anxiety, we take it so seriously, and we are I'm thinking of the neurobiology, but really it's about having that compassion and curiosity for how is this this is designed to help me be in homeostasis. And so if I align my mind and my body together as it's trying to work with me, and I can gain control over that, it feels empowering, I think mm-hmm. to be able to tie that together. Not everybody loves the neuro part.
Yeah, I love the neuro part. I wanted to bring up for our listeners, I noticed that we're using the word stress and anxiety, and I think maybe we should explain how that operates. And I have an explanation in my mind if you'd like me to share, or Craig, you can take it.
Yeah, I think the way that we talked about it a little bit last episode was, or this is the way that we describe it, and of course there's more than one way, is like stress is kind of what's happening in the body and anxiety is kind of what's happening in the mind. But mm-hmm. why don't you tell us a little bit about, I guess you said you had an example.
I came across an example, because I really wanted to explain this in a very neatly packaged way mm-hmm. for clients to understand, and I came across this explanation of like a spectrum. So you imagine a line, and at the beginning of the line, there's no stress. And then the next line would be stress. And the next stop would be anxiety. And then the next stop would be panic attacks. And so the mm-hmm. idea is that these experiences exist on a spectrum. And the more stressed out you get, the more chronically stressed you are, it can turn into anxiety. And anxiety can turn into panic attacks.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that?
I think that anything that helps a person gauge where they are as far as intensity with things mm-hmm. is good. I think that it's kind of like whenever you're going to school and you do the likeness scales yeah. and everybody hates them. All right, I understand why people hate them, but I think that they're so helpful for us, especially to gauge the intensity of emotions, mm-hmm. Our own emotions, I should say, because someone can be at a 10 and your 10 is very right. different than their 10.
Right.
But if you can be like, hey, around this area with my stress, I know that if I don't do something, it's going to take me to kind of like this next stage. And mm-hmm. whenever I get to this next stage, right. I know that whenever I get there, I'm too far gone, mm-hmm. right, mm-hmm. for this skill or this technique or anything mm-hmm. like that. And more awareness of that. And I think that even like I'm a visual person. It's like whenever you're talking about that, like I kind of imagine the scale kind of like where I'd be at, like mm-hmm. whenever it's pushing mm-hmm. certain ways, like, okay, like where am I at? Like how close am I to that panic attack realm? Because that's like the worst part, right? That's the part that we're always trying to stay yeah. away from. Yep. So I think
two people want to come in when they have the panic attacks. It's like, okay, that's fine. We're so happy to see you. But it would have been really wonderful on the more preventative side to come in before the anxiety became mm-hmm. so, overwhelming in the neurobiology or in their yeah. brain, or they're not sleeping now. Now we're seeing pretty significant effects and new habits that are going to take a little bit longer to treat. But, you know, we can certainly take care of them. But panic, they say, I had a client come in last week and he says, I don't know where it's coming from. I don't know. I'm going through a divorce. My kids are fighting with me. They're transitioning at my job. I have no idea why I'm panicking and I can't sleep. Right? This is what clients come in and say. So this is pretty typical for people by the time they come to speak with us.
Well, I think one of the hard things, too, is once you have a panic attack, you have now learned that I want to avoid this at whatever cost. So the closer you get to that, you're going to build up anxiety for trying to thwart the anxiety attack,
I love that. Yeah.
which is then going to build up the level of intensity and how quickly it is. And I think a visual for this, like you're heading towards a cliff. Once you fall off the cliff, you're having the panic attack, right? The more and more that you're worried about the panic attack, the more and more that cliff is dropping out from under you, right? It's kind of like kind of like in a lot of those action movies, right, where the ground's falling out, the cliff's getting closer and closer, and you got to try to run away from it.
I was imagining Looney Tunes.
Yeah.
with the
Roadrunner.
Who's the bird? Yes, with yeah, Roadrunner.
Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that, like you said, that's probably the worst thing is whenever you wait too long, you do have a panic attack. It makes things a lot harder because panic attacks are so intrusive that they a lot of times create a trauma in themselves whenever mm-hmm. you have it. Mm-hmm. And then you got kind of another thing to try to contend with, and that makes
it's
really hard.
Yeah, it's that feedback loop that we talked about between the brain and then the body. Mm-hmm. And so any stress relieving we can do before it gets to panic attack and even in between panic attack. So you'll notice after the panic, you might just feel so drained. Mm-hmm. That's actually really a good time for you to just rest and even maybe lay on your back and try Nidra Yoga, where you scan the body and you just notice your breath and how that energy's come out of you, and you might be a little drained. That in itself can kind of insert that parasympathetic response in the body. Mm-hmm. And just a couple of things I wanted to talk about with the vagus nerve that we didn't talk about last time. When we think about vagal tone, I think it's important to think about, like, as a nurse, you'll check someone's uvula. So that little thing that's hanging in the back of your throat, we'll put a little...
The thing I never know how to spell correctly.
Right? So just move your tongue and just look in a mirror and just kind of notice when you swallow, does your uvula lift? If it's not moving at all, you probably don't have good vagal tone when you're thinking of that cranial.
That's really interesting. I call it the hanging ball.
Very nice. That's important, but we don't think about it. So one of the things to treat vagal tone for my clients that have really severe trauma, like PTSD, we teach them to gargle, like either salt water in the morning or like mouthwash. Gargling starts to help that part. And then this tearful part of the throat, using VU is something that's used in like somatic experiencing or your vote, you know, just invoking, singing in the car, getting that tone in and out, just that's really helpful when we're thinking of that vagal tone. These are things to combat anxiety or stress at any level, and you can do these things throughout the day along with that breath. That diaphragmatic breathing is relieving some of that. It's coming out, and that epinephrine is coming out. So it's kind of like a buildup of stress in the body. So that's a good way to kind of regulate that.
So yoga, gargling, singing...
Diaphragmatic breathing, box breathing.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Pendulation, like rocking back and forth, shifting from the negative thought to something soothing. That opens that window of tolerance when you're thinking about that vagus nerve being triggered. And we talked last time about titration. So that's a medical word, but I like to think of bubbles in a sink. Like you're a kid playing and you pour too much, you know, soap in the sink and you turn it on and you're trying to get rid of it, but it's getting bigger and bigger. It's kind of like anxiety or epinephrine, but if we titrate the sink little on, little off until the bubbles kind of go down the sink, that's kind of a good way to regulate not only the anxiety but that vagus nerve
as
well.
That's an amazing visual. Thank you.
Well, I think that, so we kind of talked about a lot of things that we use. I kind of want to kind of give some plugs to some things that I think that are good things that other people might use or that research says that's good, but I'm going to admit that I don't use.
Right? All right, all the things we don't do.
Oh, yeah. So I think the most easy and obvious one for me is like meditation. I'm not a big meditator. Like I've done it for, I did it for actually a while, probably like a 6 month period. And, you know, I worked my way up to like half an hour meditations like that. But it is. It's hard.
I just gave I just gave meditation as a quote prescription this week as I was thinking to myself, I never do that.
Yeah. And so I'm usually pretty honest with people. Like, I don't do this. It is something that's really hard, but some people, they grab onto it and they can latch onto it. And I am envious of them because from what we know, what research says, this is probably one of the best things for any type of anxiety. So if you decide that you're like, hey, I want to try this, start out within between 30 seconds and 2 minutes. You want to go really short so that you don't give yourself time to get too discouraged.
You're building a muscle.
Yeah, it's really hard to go pretty long. Like I've heard of people trying to start at 15 minutes. Like if I started at 15 minutes, I would not have been doing this for 6 months or anything like that. I think that people also find meditations in different ways. I was never a person that can sit and meditate and just focus on my breathing. I had to focus on some other physical sensation, so I'd usually focus on like the rising and falling of my chest or something, or the temperature of the air coming in and going out. So,
ambient noise.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
my favorite.
So I think that for different people, there's different things that they can focus on. And I think the main thing about it is you're building up, like you said, that muscle with it, that ability, the capability, really, of being able to do that and just observe something.
Right. Don't sit and do it for a minute and than say you can't do it. You need practice.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Practice makes perfect.
Mm-hmm. I think there's a couple good apps for this. I don't know if you guys are familiar with them. Can you talk about them? Because I can't remember their names.
Oh, my. Now you put me on the spot.
Headspace, I know, is one.
Calm. Calm is another one.
Calm. Mm-hmm. I can't remember because I don't use them. Well, I know. But I'm like, yes, there are apps.
Yeah, I know Headspace is one of the big ones whenever I was doing it. That's what I used. I think that for people that are like, hey, I want to go all in on meditation and they like the biofeedback. So what I mean by that is if you're listening to this and you're like, oh, like Craig is playing the game where he's trying to get his heart rate down. Well, I would encourage you to get something like Muse. That's mm-hmm. easy peasy. You put something on your head mm-hmm. and it kind of lets you know, like whenever you're meditating, it gives you a soundscape in the background. I'm partial to the beach one where whenever you're nice and your thoughts are calm and you're focused, it's nice and calm beach and you hear these birds in the background. And when your thoughts are a little more active and you're not paying attention as much, then the soundscape for the beach is more like a storm kind of thing or heavier waves or anything. Mm-hmm. So that feedback kind of lets you know whenever you're moving away from that target zone that you're aiming for.
Okay, what was that called?
Muse.
Muse?
Yep, I have a headband at home.
That is amazing. Oh, yeah. How does it know?
So the version I have is actually a pretty rudimentary device. It's just trying to measure alpha brain waves. It's since gotten a lot more advanced, and I think they're on like their third rendition now or
that's
something
amazing.
Like that. Whenever I got mine, it was like a $150 headband. I think now they can go up to like $300.
I have
something.
One too. It's NeuroSky. It's just a little bit more, but it gives you like three brain waves. So I'm ADHD, mm-hmm. so I tend to go into high beta. I talk really quick, and my thoughts mm-hmm. come in patterns. It allows me to get into that alpha state a little bit.
It makes you practice.
Yeah, it really helps a lot. And one other thing, before you even try meditation, a lot of people do guided imagery. And I think that can be really a good segue to work your way into that meditation state. Again, with ADHD or people with anxiety have a really hard time being in their body or in their mind. So to have something to focus and teach you to kind of get into that a little bit, it's like dipping your foot in the pool. You can kind of test the waters before we start swimming. Yeah. I think that can be really helpful too.
There's an app for that.
What is that?
I don't know what
there's also thousands of YouTube videos.
Oh, the YouTube videos are amazing.
Yeah, I prefer the Australian voices myself.
The Honest Guys are my favorite. That one's a favorite plug I use almost every night.
Yeah. But I just to let you guys, so those are all free resources, by the way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Besides the Muse headband, I like the biofeedback. I think I know that you do too, Nicole.
HeartMath. That one's very inexpensive to have, and mm-hmm. it's a beginning biofeedback with the heart rate, and that helps with coherency, that flow state we keep talking about where our heart rate and our breath are kind of in sync.
Yeah, I want to make sure I hit this before I forget. So I realize I've been using the term biofeedback, and some people may not have been able to infer what that is, or they may not know. So biofeedback is whenever you're getting feedback with biological functions in your body. So like my heart rate monitor biofeedback is giving me feedback on my heart rate. And whenever you know that feedback, you can actually in real time a lot of times see the adjustments that you're making and how it's affecting your body. It's really helpful. I think that like you're talking about some of these things to try before. And I was thinking of this, gosh, I cannot remember what the program was called. It was one of my favorites, though. These balls would just fly over the computer screen, and you had like one of those finger things that would be measuring your blood pressure. And whenever you do your breathing exercises, the balls would calm down. And as soon as you jump a little bit, the balls would be really messy. So you're practicing trying to get them all nice and calm. And then if you really... if you're like me, which you're like just messing and you like to experiment with stuff, I would amp myself up really, really high, and then I'd see how fast I can calm myself down. Mm-hmm. Amp myself up really high and see how fast I can calm myself down. All that is you practicing how to change or adjust things in your body, and you get used to the feelings of that, right?
The regulation.
Yeah.
Right.
I know what it's like when my body's calm. I know what it's like when it's amped up. And you can use technology to let you know, oh, I am in this state or anything. Because mm-hmm. I don't know if you guys have this experience, but sometimes people tell me that they're feeling calm and I know they're not.
Incongruent with what you're saying and what I'm feeling.
Yes. So this is actually a pretty common thing that happens with a lot of different mental health disorders. Actually, you probably see it all the time with trauma, where we may think that we're in a calm state, but someone can look at us and they can be like, no, you don't look calm. You don't sound like you're calm or anything like that. So these different devices are really helpful with that because they give us a feedback, especially from people that we don't want telling us that we're angry or upset or anything like that. Right? I'm not going to get upset at my muse for telling me that I can't focus for 3 minutes.
Right. It's not personal.
Yeah. I'm trying to think if there's another thing that
tool I'd like to share if I could. Not everybody has it. A lot of chiropractors have it, but I've added it to my practice, and it's really helpful. It's called Brain Tap.
Okay.
And it's a device that goes over the eye, so anybody with seizures wouldn't be able to use the eye component, but they're waves of light that hit the back of the retina. And what that's doing is very calming. It's very, it feels like you're floating through space or under the water swimming. It's just a wonderful sensation in the body, and it's very calming, and it also has the binaural beats in the ears. So it's doing the bilateral, and it's hitting it from every angle that you can imagine. Mm-hmm. And there's probably like 30 different types of software with that. So for PTSD, anxiety, stress relief, sleep, and it's a guided imagery, so people are talking with you in a certain level of sound, so it's tapping into that subconscious. So it's a great tool to have, Brain Tap.
Yeah, you said something about like the floating, and I felt like I wanted to plug this really quick. Whenever you do the, have any of you guys ever done those float pods or whatever where you go into the...
I really want to.
Oh, yeah. So this is what people tell me, is like it's basically meditation on steroids because you're kind of forced into... They're called sensory deprivation pods. So the temperature is controlled. It's all the same thing. So you become desensitized. It's completely dark, usually completely soundless, or you'll have slight noise in there. I think you can play music in them if you want to. Since it's salt water, you're only smelling that.
Well, and so, the salt in and of itself is reacting with your body as well to rid you of toxins and everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you are completely cut off from all of your senses. So if you want to talk about like ways to kind of break into meditation, that from what people tell me is the easiest way to do it.
Mm-hmm. Acupuncture is amazing too.
I love that. I think that's wonderful. The sleep chamber or the float spa, really interesting. Being a therapist and being able to manage my mind and my anxiety quite well freaked me out the first 10 minutes. I mean, it really took a lot of skill. I was in a panic. It is the most silence. It is so still. I have never been in that state in my entire life. And so it took me a few minutes to relax. And by the end of it, I was dozing.
That's amazing.
So it was, talk about spectrum of your line from stress into panic. I mean, it really just took me there really quickly. And even that evening, I was able to sleep. So
I'm going
really
floating.
I'm kind of curious about the quality of that sleep, too. So
yeah.
We talked a little bit about this, too. Like sometimes people go into a stress response and they might not know whenever they get out. Well, usually whenever you go to sleep, you've gotten into a safe enough place that your body is allowing that. So it's interesting to see, like, all right, like how much was your body calmed down at that point? And, you know, because we talk about like a lot of people that have trauma or different anxiety disorders, they'll fall asleep, but it's not the same quality of sleep. It's very restless. They're not in the more important stages as long or anything like that, so it's not restful. They're not as restful at all for them. So I'd be really curious. We should have you do it and hook you up to a little brain monitor there.
I just wanted to hear a little bit more about your acupuncture and acupressure and some of these other things. I think those are great holistic tools to use.
Yeah. Well, I first experimented with acupuncture because me and my husband were having a difficult time conceiving, and we actually never did conceive. We kind of let that go. We have 4 kids in between us anyway, so it's like we have enough children. But I started in acupuncture because of infertility, and then got more interested in it because I have a son with ADHD. And so we started doing some acupuncture with him. But my experience with acupuncture is that it moves your energy around, and it's very relaxing. I've left acupuncture sessions feeling like I'd just gotten a massage, but I hadn't. So I don't know much about the science behind it. I just know that it works, and it's really amazing.
I think that's probably something important that we should talk about too. There are a lot of things that are maybe not as science-based therapies, but that people report that work. And I think we kind of even talked about this. Hey, you know what? the placebo effect works just as good as regular things, right?
Yeah.
So I think that people are really into the research and science and like what works and everything. But at the end of the day, what we perceive as working for us is more important, right? If I am, someone sits there and tells me that, like, hey, meditation is the only way that you can reduce your anxiety. And I'm like, well, I don't know. My whole thing of jumping into my ball of thoughts and knocking them out works pretty well for me. Well, if it works well for me, then it works well for me. So I like to say that because I think that it's really easy for us to knock different things. Like to think of tapping or like the Himalayan salt lamps or...
Speaking of salt... St. Louis Salt Room and Palm Health both obviously have salt rooms, but they're traditionally used for like upper respiratory issues, allergies, things like that. But the salt really helps balance out your bodily functions and helps reduce stress and anxiety. Yeah, again, one of those things I've experimented
with. Yeah, got another thing here that reduces stress and anxiety.
Oh, yeah, you have my therapy dog in training over there by you, Ziggy Craren. Her big sister Piper is usually with me everywhere I go.
Yeah, so but I think that's pretty important, is a lot of times animals can really help calm us down, animals that we're not allergic to, so...
And just petting the dog actually gives oxytocin, so it's very healing when you think about epinephrine. If you're thinking about anxiety, just petting the dog for 5 minutes can bring you down from an 8 to a 6.
Always always bringing it back to the science base. Yeah. All right, so we kind of offered a lot of different options here, and of course there are tons more, and I think that the most important thing that we can kind of let you guys know today is that it's what works for you. Be a little bit experimental. You can try some of the things that work for us. Try some of the things that work for you. It's really important for you to find something that you're comfortable with doing, right? If you're not comfortable doing breathing exercises, guess what? It's probably not going to work for you, right? If you're already feeling anxiety, you don't want to put yourself in a situation where you're feeling anxiety about something not working for you that you think is supposed to. Right, so I want you to walk into these situations thinking that like, hey, this might not actually work for me, and it's okay if it doesn't. That just means that I have to try something else. Everybody's body is designed to be able to be calmed down, right? And that means that we just have to find the opportunity, what works for us.
Yeah, and the combinations change, Craig. I love that we not only offered some of these different solutions, but I'm always seeking new ways because maybe what worked for me last year isn't working this year. Mm-hmm. So I think always keeping that open is really a good thing.
Definitely. So I want to thank you ladies for joining me today and us being able to have the opportunity to talk about this. I hope that this episode is helpful for you, especially if you're experiencing anxiety in your life. I think that probably... What is new research talks about, like 80 to 90% of Americans experience anxiety on a regular basis.
You are normal.
Yeah.
Within normal limits.
Definitely. So again, thank you for joining us here at Mental Health Insights, and we look forward to the next time that we talk with you guys. I don't know. I'm not really sure what we're going to talk with you guys about. I think we got some ideas, though. I don't know if we'll kind of stick with this train, or maybe we'll start talking about some trauma or something like that.
I would love to talk about bilateral stimulation with you.
All right. Maybe we'll start talking about that then. All right. Until then, we wish you all well. Thank you for listening to our show. This podcast is designed to provide accurate and reliable information, and those that appear on the show are all licensed professionals in the area of mental health counseling. We are in no way rendering legal or medical advice, only information to help serve you better in making decisions in your life. If you need a professional, you should find one. The music you are listening to is called Lobby Time, and that is by Kevin MacLeod and licensed through Creative Commons.